able to draw on the expressive resources of these lyrical traditions, that is, nature poetry and poetry of place. So the American tradition probably most of you know reasonably well. Interest in the creation and reception of nature poetry, of course, has waxed and waned in the U.S. over the course of the 20th century. But I think it's not unfair to say that there is an essentially unbroken tradition in this genre that runs from late 20th century poets like Gary Snyder, A.R. Ammons, and Hayden Carruth, back to Walt Whitman's celebrations of the American landscape, and, of course, all the way back to Thoreau and Emerson. That tradition derives its continuity from several factors. Perhaps most importantly, American poets throughout the 20th century have had a consistent interest in the literary exploration of place. Even poets whom one wouldn't want to classify primarily as nature poets, I'm thinking of figures such as Wallace Stevens, William Carlos Williams, or Charles Olson, were intensely concerned with the significance of local communities and landscapes. And in their poems, they explored the relation of these landscapes to individual life stories, as well as the history of larger entities such as the nation. So think of Charles Olson's Gloucester, William Carlos Williams's Paterson, Wallace Stevens's Florida, and so forth. After World War II, one might have expected the interest in nature to diminish with the force of the American industrial push and increasing urbanization and suburbanization. Some of the beat poets rediscovered it through the detour of East Asian art, culture, and religion. And the countercultural movement of the 1960s, one of whose central concerns was the return to nature, or at any rate the return to what was perceived to be a more natural style of living, prompted a renewed interest in the natural environment, and that even before interest or awareness of the environmental crisis took hold. As a consequence, ecological poetry, as it emerged in the course of the 60s and 70s, had a wide array of poetic strategies at its disposal and could build on a long tradition of writing and reading that cherished nature and a sense of place as indispensable components of human identity. The emergence of eco-poetry in the two Germanies took place under quite different circumstances. Now, in German literature, you have an equally long tradition of nature poetry that runs from Romanticism to the Expressionism of the 19-teens and 20s. But the genre then did follow a very different trajectory in the 20th century due to the transformative influence of the Nazi period. And that, of course, poetry is not unlike many other literary and aesthetic genres. To begin with, let me explain a little bit what I mean by that. So to begin with, certain aspects of the aesthetic reflection on and celebration of nature were appropriated by Nazi ideology in such a way that it became really difficult to include them in non- or anti-Nazi poetry. So this sort of nationalistically tinged veneration of nature and the local landscape, summed up in the Pledge of Allegiance to Blut und Boden, blood and soil, was part and parcel of National Socialist ideology. And concepts such as the German forest and the strength of the German oak were turned into icons of the Nazist regime. Nazi poetry often used concepts such as the soil to cement the unity of the German people, and images such as storm, thunder, or lightning to naturalize violence as a political means of expression. Notions such as Heimat, home, and the genre of Heimatlyrik, so home poetry, or whatever you might want to translate it, which is the closest German equivalent to the American poetry of place, could easily be appropriated for such ideological purposes, even though some leftist poets fought hard to reclaim it. So that's one part of the historical picture, is the appropriation of a certain part of the Romantic tradition and natural symbols for the purposes of fascist propaganda. But perhaps even more crucial for later developments was the role nature played for poets of the so-called inner immigration, the inner emigration, inner exile, poets who did not sympathize with the Nazi regime but chose to remain in Germany. For some of these poets, and prominent names here would include Wilhelm Lehmann and Oskar Loerke, nature became a place of refuge from the political, social, and cultural ravages of Nazism. They attributed to it what came to be called Naturmagie, nature magic, almost magical powers to preserve the individual and retain a degree of harmony even in the midst of disaster. Now, the consequence of that particular kind of poetry for German poetry after 1945 was to effectively foreclose what might have become, with some modifications, a potential source of eco-poetry. Indeed, to some extent, it disabled the continuing creation of nature poetry more broadly understood, which became a relatively insignificant genre after the war, and that's a development that I'll talk more about in just a minute. Now, a third factor is this. It was, of course, an important group of writers in the 1930s and 40s. Those that did leave Germany went into exile. Many German poets didn't get around to writing a great deal of nature poetry during their exile, in part, no doubt, as one critic has pointed out, because many of them had to change countries quite often and therefore didn't have much time to experience any particular place in depth. But they also avoided the genre because they felt conflicted about devoting much attention to nature at a time when the most pressing issues seemed overwhelmingly social and political. That conflict manifests itself clearly in the work of Bertolt Brecht, particularly in this poem called An die Nachgeborenen, to those born after, of which I just put just a few lines on the back of your handout under three, where it says, "What times are these when a conversation about trees is almost a crime because it implies silence about so many misdeeds?" Now, those are not lines that I think we should understand to characterize Brecht's own attitude toward nature or his lyrical production in exile. He wrote numerous poems while he was in exile that prove his deep interest and concern about nature. But these lines did achieve notoriety for the post-war generation as a summary indictment of literary discourses about nature that were designed to evade political realities and responsibilities. So in 1977, an issue of the literary magazine Tintenfisch, Squid, which was dedicated to the new environmental literature, found it necessary deliberately to invert Brecht's dictum in its editorial introduction. So Christopher Buch, the editor of that issue, argued that by the 1970s, it was, quote, almost a crime not to talk about trees, given also a very prominent concern in Germany at the time with the die-off of forests, the so-called Waldsterben, which was sort of a major obsession with the environmentalist movement, sort of the acid rain induced dying off of the forests. So the principal legacy of Nazism for the genre of nature poetry, therefore, was that nature in German literature became firmly associated with political escapism. That's not to imply that nature poetry was no longer written after 45, even though it was hardly a major genre. In West Germany, nature continued to be the realm of refuge for those who resisted the reconstruction of the Adenauer years with the rearmament of the German army, the introduction of nuclear weapons, and the gradual transformation of West Germany into a consumer economy. In East Germany, the GDR, nature appeared in poetry mainly by way of rural scenarios that celebrated the liberation of the soil and the villages by socialist agriculture. Ecological movements and initiatives took on force in West Germany in the late 1960s, whereas in the GDR, the green push didn't gain momentum until the mid to late 1970s. But interestingly, that time lag isn't reflected in the literature of the two countries. In both parts of Germany, eco-poetry emerged at about the same time in the early to mid-1970s. There's one notable exception to this. The West German poet and public intellectual Hans Magnus Enzensberger, one of the most eminent German poets of the 20th century, in whose poems ecological problems began to surface already in the late 1950s. He has two collections of poems, one from 1957 and one from 1960, and even in 1957 he has one poem where he describes poison boiling in the tomatoes. It was sort of an anticipation of a Rachel Carson-esque scenario. Now, as may already be clear from this extremely brief survey of nature poetry as a genre, German poets in the 1970s who wanted to address ecological challenges faced a very different task from their American counterparts. They had to develop a lyrical idiom that would show the natural world as it was being endangered by industrial civilization, but without lapsing into the idealizations that would once again turn it into an escape from the realm of politics. Both East and West German poets accomplished this by focusing on bleak scenarios of natural destruction. Many of these poems revolve around landscapes dominated by smokestacks and pollution, concrete that seems to spread almost on its own, industrial machinery that rips the soil open, consumer trash littered about, and a culture that cherishes the fake and the artificial over the natural. In West Germany, in addition, an entire subgenre of poems and folk songs developed around the very sustained protest against the construction of nuclear power.